London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, folks.
Hello and welcome to Yesterday's Chip Paper, the fortnightly-ish podcast where we look at strange and bizarre and macabre stories from the historic newspaper archives. My name is Violet.
And mine is Jim. And we are, if you haven't listened to the show before, we are just a couple of amateur researchers who like old newspapers. And every couple of weeks, we get together and tell each other a story that we found in the olden news.
Olden news and times.
Olden news and times. It works. It works. Listen, I'm a professional.
Look, I'm going with it.
So, yeah, so it's stories about, like monkey stealing trains and all that sort of stuff that we like. And this week it's my turn to tell a story.
It is your turn.
It is my turn.
What have you found?
Well,
you should ask that. Here's a story I prepared earlier.
Well, this is funny actually because it's funny because none of this is funny. But I was reading a story about a father and son in a hotel in Brighton who were really like. He really loved his son, the son really loved his dad. And then in the middle of the night, the dad killed the son and threw himself out of the window and landed on some railings and died.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That was a big leap from the first sentence.
Yeah, it went south fast. so I was reading that and it referenced this thing, this other case. Called they called it the Kerwan case, K-I-R-W-A-N. But what the press called it was the they called it the Ireland's Eye murder, and it was this huge. It was 1852 in Ireland, near the Eye of Ireland, and it was it was like the biggest scandal to hit 19th century. Well, one of it was a huge scandal to hit the Irish news, which means that there's a lot of reporting on it. Which means oftentimes when there's a lot of reporting, it makes something more difficult to.
Yeah, you'd think it was the reverse.
Yeah,
but especially
not.
Like with the Titanic last time, it was it was the hardest one I've ever researched, even though you'd think it would be the easiest.
Yeah, it's all over the place. So this one is not a lot of fun.
Okay.
But it has every ingredient that you want from a Victorian scandal. I mean, it has every ingredient that you want from a Victorian scandal. And some you don't need, but they're in there.
Those are just unnecessary now.
Yeah, this was flavouring now. So Ireland's Eye is an island off the coast of Ireland.
Oh, see, it's already off to such a great start.
Ireland squared. It's a small island and no one lives there, but it is popular with... It's popular now with tourists and it was popular then with tourists. You get ferries out there and you wander around. There's ruins of an old church there from like the 8th century.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a nice place to go. People get boats over from the mainland. And then in my notes, I've just written, it's nice. so that's all you need to know. A couple who in 1852 thought it would be nice to visit, and then it wasn't nice to visit, were Maria Theresa Kerwin and William Burke Kerwin, who lived in Howth, which is an island, and that is the level of research I've done.
An island in Ireland? But a different island than Ireland.
No, Howth is just in Ireland. I can tell that I can tell the fact that my accent has worn away completely over the years. It's going to create a lot of problems in this podcast. Howth is in Ireland.
Okay, right.
It is not an island.
You haven't lost us yet.
Right. Well, good, because I'm four sentences in. So they lived in Howth. They didn't live in Howth for about a month. They'd lived around and about. William was an artist. And he would frequently go over to Ireland's Eye to sketch and paint and such. And Theresa, so she's alternately called Maria and Theresa, depending what source you read.
Okay.
I think I'm going to stick with Maria because it was her first name. So Maria would go to bathe in Ireland's tropical waters.
Very nice.
A lot of the newspaper reports, about this case, and this is what makes it a Victorian scandal that is, you know, kind of tailor-made, commented on how attractive she was.
Okay, right.
I
mean, that adds a certain element to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, an unnecessary element. You know, I didn't need to know it. You didn't need to know it. But now we all know it together, I suppose. One day in September 1852, they made the journey over to the island, and it would be the last journey that Maria would ever make. The Dublin Evening Mail reported on the 8th of September, "Melancholy death by drowning. Yesterday, Henry Davis, Esquire, one of the county coroners, held an inquest in Howth on view of the body of a lady named Miss Maria Kirwan, who came by her death under the following melancholy circumstances. The deceased was a remarkably handsome woman." That's when it's getting strange.
Okay, yeah, that was an unnecessary detail at that point of the story.
About 32 years of age. The first witness examined was a fisherman named Patrick Nangle.
So what did he look like? Was he particularly attractive?
His surname was Nangle, so let's go from there and work backwards. Who deposed that he was employed by Mr. Kirwan to leave him and Mrs. Kirwan on Island's Eye on Monday morning. Mr. Kirwan had told him to be ready at 8 o'clock in the morning. Witness, Nangle, and three other men took them in a boat to Island's Eye and left them there at about 10 o'clock in the morning. Mrs. Kirwan had told them to return to the island at 8. At that hour, when they returned with the boat and the same three men, when within about 12 perches of the island, I don't know what perches, witness hailed the Kirwans. Mm-hmm. It was then very dark. Mr. Kirwan answered and said he was there. They got into the landing place, and Mr. Kirwan, who was on the bank above, desired one of the men to go up for the bag which they had with them. Witness went for the bag. Mr. Kirwan was by himself, and he and one of the boatmen, named Michael Nangle, went off to look for Mrs. Kirwan. The witness remained a short time behind and then followed.
I thought he hailed both of them.
Kirwan hailed the boat. No, he hailed both of them like, "Hey guys, hey."
Okay, so he can actually see both of them.
Yeah, but
okay.
only William comes over to the landing spot. Okay. So they go looking for Maria. They search along the east side of the island where at low water mark they find her lying on her back with her bathing dress on her about her waist. A sheet was beside her, partly under her. She had also bathing boots on, which, fine. The body was on the rock, just out of the water, and witness believed it was the rock that prevented it from being carried out to sea. Her clothes were 10 or 15 yards from where the body was found, on a rock about 6 feet from the water's edge. It was close to where the ladies bathe when they go on the island. Witnesses had brought Mr. and Mrs. Kirwan over to the island the 2 days previous. Mrs. Kirwan wanted to stay as late as 8 o'clock, but they came over rather sooner. So Michael Nangle said that he went over to Mr. Kirwan, to William, and asked him what happened, where she was. And Mr. Kirwan responded, "She went down to bathe a little after the shower, which was about 6 o'clock. He said he was in trouble, that he had gone along the strand to look for her, but could not find her or hear her voice. He and witness then went along the strand on the east side. It was not low water mark, where they found the deceased wedged in between two rocks, partly on her back and her feet in the water. Mr. Kirwan covered the body with a sheet and a shawl, and they brought it to the boat. They searched for the clothes, but could not find them. When Mr. Kirwan higher up the rocks and found them, it was about 10 o'clock when they found the body. Mr. Kirwan appeared to be in very great trouble when she was discovered." So
okay.
She's drowned.
And he's either in trouble because he's guilty and he's freaking out, or there's been some kind of accident and he's just found his dead wife.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't... When they arrived...
something else has happened.
What, like Cthulhu?
Like someone else has done something. But if no one lives there, then...
There's just two people on an island.
This is complete speculation now.
Yeah, you just lead it.
I'm just throwing ideas out there and seeing what happens.
You can't do that. It's historical.
Are you telling me that's not what happens for the rest of the story now?
I feel
like that's a bit of a running theme through all of our episodes.
This isn't news karaoke.
Okay.
But that was a witness account of what happened. The fisherman came back, Maria nowhere to be found, William distraught, they find her drowned. Mm-hmm. Then William, when he was examined about this, as he would be, "I am an artist residing at number 11 Upper Merrion Street," and I've left that in case somebody who lives there is listening to this. I was married to her with my wife. I was married to her about 9 or 10 years, which turns out eventually it was 12 years, I think. "I've been living with Mrs. Kirwan at Howth 5 or 6 weeks and was in the habit of going over to Island's Eye as an artist. Mrs. Kirwan used to accompany me. She was very fond of bathing, and while I sketched, she used to roam about or bathe. On yesterday, she went over as usual. She bathed at the foot of the Martell Tower and could not stay longer in the water as the boatmen were to bring another party to the island. She left me in the latter part of the day, about 6 o'clock, to bathe again. She told me she would walk round the hill after bathing and meet me at the boat. I did not see her alive afterwards and only found the body described by the boatman." And then the really crucial part, and this is all the same article. People wrote essays about this. Mr. James Alexander Hamilton, a medical student, deposed that he had examined the body of the deceased. There were no marks of violence upon it. There were a few scratches, apparently caused by the rocks. The body presented all the appearance of that of a drowned person. The jury found that the deceased had been accidentally drowned while bathing at Ireland's Eye on the 6th instant. And there are reports everywhere. So the Belfast newsletter from the 10th of September 1852, melancholy death by drowning. And Mrs. Maria Kirwan came by her death while bathing at Ireland's Eye on Monday evening. Deceased was a highly respectable lady, about 30 years of age, and said to be remarkably handsome.
Okay, so I guess the one thing that kind of sticks out in that report is, what was the last sentence? A highly respectable lady,
yeah,
going for a walk on an island for like 2 hours and being like, I'll meet by the boat.
There's no one
else. A highly respectable lady would like go for a walk and then like get ready to be presentable on the boat.
I hadn't considered that.
See, I don't know. That was my first impression hearing that report.
Your first impression is very judgmental.
Oh, well, I'm trying.
I'm just making it aware that might be a development area for you. So she went down to bathe, she got in trouble, she drowned. And that is what the story is. The jury return accidental death. So that's it. Wrong.
Okay.
I even put haha in my notes. So this is where this is going to get good. Time moves on a little bit and the case hasn't gone away because it's a handsome, respectable lady.
Were there any artist depictions?
Not that I could find.
Oh, it's a shame.
I find...
See, who knows if they're telling the truth now?
I mean...
Just saying.
In 1850, I think to be handsome was just has teeth. Not too bad.
Own teeth, had, own hair.
not too bad smallpox. So the reporting on this is a bit all over the place because some of the publications are weekly, some of them are daily, and they, you know, they'll report the same news out of sync and things like that. So I'm going to do my best with this narrative. And if you know about this case and you think that the order that I'm giving it is wrong or there's things missing, this is 100% based on newspapers from 1852 and 1853. That's the only resource I'm using for this. So I'm doing my best. So.
We believe in you, Jim. Go on.
Yes. Good. I'm going to read excerpts from this article from the Royal Cornwall Gazette because it's really long, but it's also really interesting because the narrative, this is from the 17th of December, 1852, so a few months later. It's kind of a retelling of the Nangle story by the Nangles, and it kind of paints a different picture of the incident of them finding the body. So when they went over, Kirwan said he hasn't seen her since the shower, meaning the shower of rain which fell at 6 o'clock. We know all that. She went to the tower to bathe. We know that. The boatman then suggested that a search should be made for her, which was ineffectual. Another search was, however, made. In the middle of the long hole, which is, I don't know what that is, was a very high rock. Patrick Nangle went to one side of the rock and Michael Nangle went to the other. But just as Patrick Nangle was moving towards the place where the body was found, Mr. Kirwan slipped and fell. And the consequence of his fall was to delay the progress of the Nangles. And it would appear that at the very instant of Mr. Kirwan's fall, Patrick Nangle perceived something white, and on proceeding to the spot where it was found, it was the body of the prisoner's wife. So that doesn't necessarily suggest he was hampering the search, but if you thought he was guilty of her murder, that's how you would perceive it for sure. And then it goes on. Her bathing cap was missing, and the body was certainly warm when found by Patrick at 10 o'clock. When they arrived at the spot, Mr. Kirwan rushed forward and threw himself on the body and exclaimed, "Oh, Maria! Oh, Maria!" That's,
that's really effective.
Thanks, that's me doing my...
I really felt that.
My Andram. And then there's a bit later on that wasn't really mentioned in the first reports of this. The body, when found, lay on its back, and the face had some marks of scratches upon it, and blood was issuing from part of the breast, from the ears, and from another part of the body. Now, I don't know what another part of the body is.
Might have been that luxurious time of the month.
Could have been. Yeah, I would like to see them try and write about that in an 1850s Irish newspaper.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, the demons were here briefly. Yeah,
you would absolutely not know what they were talking about.
So that also tells a different story. You know, the it was reported that he was really helpful and that she'd just had a few scratches, but now she's bleeding from her ears.
I don't even know what causes that.
And various other places. I think, like, so if you take a real bad knock to the head or something, like you have brain damage, and you think back on the initial inquest, and the inquest was carried out by a medical student. You know, it wasn't a seasoned coroner. So it starts to get a bit strange. There's also the talk of him, she had a bathing cap and he couldn't find it, and there was talk of him suddenly finding it somewhere, but it was totally dry, and he said he found it in water and things. So there's a lot of, like, really strange things that aren't really adding up. So the plot thickens. They hadn't lived in Howth for that long, as he said, just 5 or 6 weeks. And the person that they rented the room from was reported on thusly in the Dublin Evening Mail on the 8th of December, 1852. This has gone back to trial, and you'll see why in a minute, but these are from his trial. Margaret Campbell, examined by Mr. Pennefather. I am a widow and live at Howth. In September last, Mr. and Mrs. Kirwan lodged in my house. They had been with me from June. They had only one room, which they used as a sitting and bedroom. There was a passage between it and the kitchen. Mrs. Kirwan slept in my house every night from June. Mr. Kirwan, for about 6 weeks, slept about 3 nights in the week there. For the last month or 6 weeks, he invariably slept in my house. He was in town every day and used to return at different hours in the evening. Observed quarrels between Mr. and Mrs. Kirwan during the first month or 6 weeks. Heard words more than once. Heard him say he would make her stop there. Heard him call her out of her name. He called her a... And then it's just a long hyphen. So it doesn't say what he called her.
There's no first initial giving any sort of suggestion?
I think it might have been bitch.
Imagine a poor little old landlady like that having to say that at trial.
It could have been anything, really. It could have been bad cook. It could have been garden.
Oh, you can't slander this beautiful woman's name like that. I'm sure she was wonderful in the kitchen.
Well, that just makes this even more tragic than Violet. heard him also say that he would finish her. That was when they were about a month in the house. Heard her say, let me alone. Next morning after that, heard her say to him that she was black from the usage that she got. Don't know what that means. On the evening the quarrel took place, a woman named Anne Hanlon came in. I was in the kitchen opposite Mrs. Kirwan's room when I heard the quarrel. There was no stranger in the house next morning. Never heard anything but this, unless a word or so. Mrs. Kirwan bathed every day. She used to go to the ladies' bathing place near Howth. I recollect that Mr. and Mrs. Kirwan slept at home on the night of the 5th of September. The 6th was Monday. They went out around 10 o'clock. I knew they were going to Ireland's Eye. Which, that doesn't make any sense, because they went at 8 o'clock, but whatever. So now we've gone from him being distraught and her dying of an accident to him acting strangely, him planting evidence, her bleeding from the ears, and them having domestic quarrels for at least a month before the accident.
It's all looking very suspicious now.
It's starting to, yeah. And this is all coming out. I mean, as I've said, this
and
is
I'm,
all
And I'm like speculating that being black from the usage she got is her being beaten up.
Yeah, I think so, probably.
So,
unless she actually was a chimney sweep's brush. That was where she made her
money.
I mean,
there's that too.
She died of black lung. So what I'm about to tell you will shock you. It probably won't shock you. It probably just more confirm what you're already thinking. The two articles that I read from above, as I said, are from William's trial. He was arrested on suspicion of the murder of Maria.
Mm-hmm.
But the main catalyst behind that was one of the main catalysts behind that was bonkers. And a lot of the outrage about William, is that he didn't protect his wife, and that was seen as a husbandly duty. But that was more like a moral, social obligation. The legal reason he came under suspicion was very, very sordid, actually. And the sort of thing you couldn't get away with these days, with all the social medias, your Snapchats.
Those dastardly medias got us again.
Court Constitution, Saturday, 11th of December, 1852. The prisoner was indicted for the murder of Maria Kirwan, she being his wife. They were married 12 years ago, but had no family. The evidence which the Crown intended to adduce in the present instance was not what was called, in the language of the legal profession, direct, but circumstantial evidence. That was the thing with all of this, is that everything was circumstantial.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, there's no hard proof. In saying that the case was important from the nature of the crime, he also told them that it was committed upon the wife of the prisoner at the bar, upon the person whom of all others it was his duty to cherish and protect. So he's, you know, you they're accusing him of murdering the person he should be protecting, and that's makes the, you know, morally makes the crime a lot worse in some way. In the present instance, however, he was afraid that affection did not go hand in hand with duty, because he apprehended it would be proved to their satisfaction in the course of the trial that although the prisoner had been married to this woman 12 years, during the whole of that period he had lived with another female by whom he had a large family of children.
William! How could he? No. But she was so beautiful.
That's why he was only staying at the boarding house 3 days a week. He had another wife, essentially, with 8 children.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Was he really wealthy?
I think he was doing okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I found...
Because that's got to be tough.
He was a medical draftsman, an anatomical draftsman.
Okay.
So I think he was doing okay. But yeah, but Maria must have been like, why are we always broke? Why do we live in one room? You're doing really well. It's like you've got 8 kids somewhere or something.
12 years, though.
Yeah, man.
I wonder if she ever had an inkling.
Neither of the women knew.
She must have had an inkling.
Neither of the women knew.
You don't know if she knew, to be fair. She wouldn't have told anyone before she died.
Well, she knew before she died. She found out about 6 months before she died. But that's why they were in that boarding home. He had 8 children. How
Jesus,
do you?
That's even
have
more
the
than my parents.
Time. I just don't. Yeah. I mean, a father of the year. You know, spending 3 days a week with him or whatever. That's Jesus. Less than half a day a kid.
I don't know if it works like that. Does it work?
It
like
does.
That?
That's how it works. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that cast suspicion on him immediately, because obviously that gave him a motive right away.
Yeah.
For murder, and also doing this in 1850s Ireland. Doing this in 1850s anywhere would have been a moral panic, but Ireland has blasphemy laws now that were introduced like 10 years ago. And I'm not denigrating the fine people of Ireland. My family live in Ireland, but it's not necessary. Well, it is now, actually. They have they were the first major country, well, first country to legalise gay marriage, I think. And they have a gay prime minister. But back then, I don't think they were the most forward-facing. He was arrested a month after Maria's death and charged with her murder. So it took a month for this all to come out. And then new details came to light, which it's stupid that they didn't come to light in the first place, in my opinion. So a person of the name of Hugh Campbell, who was leaning on the harbour wall at Howth, just leaning on the wall, just Hugh, just leany Hugh, saw the boat in question, the one that belonged to Menangle, leave the harbour and go to the island at the hour of 8 o'clock on that evening. But before that, a matter of considerable importance attracted the attention of Campbell. About an hour or so before the boat went over, he heard a loud cry coming from the island, which was more than once repeated. This occurred at 7 o'clock, or perhaps a little later, and Campbell was not the only person who heard cries about this hour of the evening. Campbell would state that the cries occurred about 3/4 of an hour before Nangle's boat went to the island.
How far away was this island?
Yeah, I was thinking this. It sounded
I swear they said it took 2 hours to get there.
I thought that.
So how loud was she screaming?
I don't know.
That's insane.
This is why it's so hard to do anything with newspapers.
Is he like a really old man with a rowboat and he can't actually move that quick?
Maybe he's walking. He's dragging it. A woman named A woman named Alice Abernathy, who lived near to the ladies' bathing place at the turn on the east side of the harbour of Howth, heard cries of a similar kind about the time mentioned by Campbell. A female named Catherine Flood, who was standing at the door of a gentleman named Singleton, also heard similar cries. A man named John Barrett heard cries likewise. I just feel like they could have just listed the people who heard cries.
Yeah.
This is
just...
That
would have saved precious column space.
It's a guy who had to make word count. A man named John Barrett heard cried likewise, and on hearing a cry came down to the harbour with a view of making himself acquainted with its cause, and he afterwards heard cries coming down towards the harbour. So now there's cries. I mean, still circumstantial, but it's just getting worse. We've gone from distraught husband finds dead body
to be fair, cries doesn't really mean... if it goes on for that long,
But this is it, this is what I mean, it's just kind of... all the little pebbles that start the avalanche, because, you know, he's gone from innocent husband finding dead wife and being distraught to philandering, to life-leading, lying, search-obstructing.
All the ings.
Too many ings.
You just don't want to be ing when you're on trial.
No. No, you want to be Ingersant. Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. If we were in the same room, I would high-five you.
This is all, but this, is, as you say, is all circumstantial. You might not have said that. Yeah. I might have said that. But it's all circumstantial. It doesn't prove murder. Unless a coroner was to... And then we, would, if it was TV, we'd do like a jump cut. but it's not TV, it's me reading stuff out. So Dr. Hatchell, who made an internal post-mortem examination, was examined at great length and expressed his belief that death had been caused by the stoppage of the respiration combined with pressure or constriction of some kind. Simple drowning would not have caused the appearances presented by the body.
Right.
So
that kind of goes against what the first report said.
The student doctor.
But...
But you think a student doctor in that position is just going to be like, yep, drowned?
I don't know. I think, speaking as someone who's never been a student doctor, I'd want to be like, I'd want to be thorough, you know? I'd be like looking just to check.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, he probably had a whole lineup of like smallpox victims that he had to get through and he was just
Loads of kids with bovine tuberculosis just waiting outside. I did read a story that he killed her with a sword stick. I couldn't find it anywhere else, but it was like, yeah, that these women who are unrelated to the case accused him of using a sword stick to stab her to death.
That is terrible that I laughed at that, but it was the description and not the action. Also, it doesn't fit with any of the rest of the story.
No, it doesn't fit with anything. There's a lot of bonkers stuff. There's a lot of bonkers stuff that doesn't fit with anything. It's almost like as soon as, in some of the articles, it's almost like as soon as his morality was void,
they just say anything.
You say anything, and people will be like, yep, sword sticks. I heard it was a sword stick. I heard he dipped it in poo and then stabbed her with it. So it's just stuff like that. So we've gone through the record scratch moments of this story. And I also like it, like, before the trial, and they're like, oh my God, this woman died. And no one was like, yeah, I heard screams. And then the trial comes around, they're like, yep, screams. I heard screams from
this is true.
2 hour away island or whatever. There was also, and this is another thing, the prosecution argued this, that they said that Kerwin chose Maria's grave and he deliberately chose one that was waterlogged so that her body would decompose faster. But he didn't choose the grave plot, his friend did, and Kerwin didn't know where it was until the day of the funeral. So there's just so much stuff is being levelled at him. That is wrong.
I mean, he doesn't necessarily sound like the greatest guy in the world, but doesn't feel like it really justifies.
Do you know what?
Saying stuff like that.
I researched this story. I wrote down what I'm saying now. I've been researching this for days. And when you said he doesn't sound like that great a guy, I was going to go, why?
Well, because...
I know why.
He's like, killed his wife, one of his wives.
We don't know that.
Well, yeah, okay, fair. I don't know. Okay, so he doesn't sound like that great a guy according to these newspaper reports.
No, Violet, he had a separate
Is
family.
Is that a better clause?
He's a terrible guy. He had a separate family. He's a terrible guy. I just forgot. Well, that makes you a bad person.
Does that make you a bad person? Well, yeah, I guess that makes you a bad person.
It makes at least makes you a bad father.
That's a big old lie.
I can't believe we just had to have that conversation. don't have kids.
I don't know.
So what is quite cool is he was sentenced to death. That's not cool. That's not. I jumped him at the wrong point of the sentence to say that. So he was sentenced to death. The date of execution was set for the 18th of January, 1853. And thanks to the Westmorland Gazette from the 18th of December, 1852, we have the actual words of the judge who passed the sentence. So the judge earnestly implored the prisoner to turn his thoughts only towards pardon from God through Christ. Do not, I implore of you, consider what I have now been saying as mere words of course or matters of official duty. I speak as one who feels what he says, as one who is convinced that your everlasting happiness or misery depends on what passes in your soul during the short period that is left to you in this world. Do, then, cast yourself on that Saviour. Keep your thoughts and your mind fixed on him. Embrace him in your love. Have confidence in his mercy, in his infinite power, and it may yet be well with you, as it has been with some who at the 11th hour repented and believed to the salvation of their souls. Having said so much, it now remains for me to pronounce upon you the last awful and solemn words of the sentence of the law. Here the learned judge assumed the black cap. Namely, that you, William Burke Kerwin, will be taken from the place where you now stand to the place from which you came, the prison, and thence you be taken to the place of execution, the gallows, and that you be there hanged by the neck until you be dead, and that your body be buried within the precinct of the jail, and may the Lord have mercy on your soul. Which, wow.
It's a harrowing thing to hear at the end of your trial.
Yeah, and also I would be like, shut up with all the God stuff. Tell me how to feel. I'm a killer. I wouldn't say
you
that.
You run away.
That would ruin my appeal.
Like, oh, shit.
I shouldn't have pleaded not guilty.
Didn't mean it.
So he's sentenced to death. And I really do think the fact that he had another family was a huge part of their belief that he had that he was immoral. I do think that had
Do you think that played a big part in his sentence as well? And what do you think he would have got?
That's difficult.
Death?
I think if you found guilty for murdering your wife, I think they would have hanged you then. But I just don't know. I personally am unsure as to whether he did it. I don't think he did. Because this theory, people weren't happy that he was about the sentence. People were really, really annoyed about it because they claimed there just wasn't the evidence that he did it. And then this huge letter writing campaign started, and there were these groups formed that set out to change the decision of the court. And this theory was circulating. This idea was put forward that Maria was epileptic and that she'd had a seizure, and that's how she drowned. The defense didn't put it forward in the first trial because they couldn't provide positive evidence. I think the newspapers were a little bit cloudy on that. But then letters started appearing after this sentence. So on the 31st of December, 1852, a letter is sent to the London Daily News from the courts in Dublin. I think they get this. It says County of the City of Dublin to wit. So I think this was submitted to the court, but it's printed in the newspapers. I, Arthur Kelly, of 15 Fleet Street in said city, artist, do solemnly and sincerely declare that I knew the deceased Sarah Maria Louisa Kerwin and was an assistant to Mr. Kerwin for 12 years. And this is weird because the other papers called her Maria Teresa, some call her Sarah Maria Louisa. And I was assistant to Mr. Kerwin for 12 years, during which time I was almost constantly in the daytime in the house in Merrion Street. I remember the deceased to have been attacked with two fits, one about 2 years ago, on which occasion there were present along with me Mr. Kerwin and a servant girl of the name of Anne Mayer, and the other in the latter end of June last, shortly before Mr. Kerwin left for the seaside, on which occasions I was below stairs in the office when I was alarmed by loud screams upstairs. On going up and seeing what was the cause, I saw the deceased lying on the floor, working in a fit, her arms and legs seemingly greatly convulsed and froth coming from her mouth. These fits, I should say, lasted half an hour each. I was summoned by the Crown on Mr. Kerwin's trial, but was not produced. So this guy was like, yeah, she has seizures, but he wasn't put in front of the judge.
Which could also account for what the people heard, if they heard anything.
Yeah, if that's what the shrieks are. During my acquaintance with Mr. and Mrs. Kerwin, I never knew them to disagree, but always to live on the best terms with one another, and I make this solemn declaration conscientiously believing the same to be true. And he wasn't the only one who said that they were a really loving couple. Like, and I know that's not necessarily uncommon in domestic abuse, that they would appear, everything would appear normal on the surface, but her mum said it as well. In a way that I didn't snip the article because I didn't want to go for the cheap laugh, but the mum said that she had near daily intercourse with her daughter, but she just meant like contact. And she said that they were really a loved up couple. So it's possible that because she found out a few months before her death that he had this other family, or there was another woman. And it's possible that it just put so much strain on things that's when it started. And that's why the person where the room that they rented saw it and no one else did, you know, that there's a million possibilities. So it's so muddy. Like, now it's possible that she was epileptic and she had a seizure and like hit her head or whatever and drowned in shallow water. So there's letters coming in from everywhere. There were so many letters being written to the press and to the courts and to everybody that the Cork Examiner on the 5th of January, 1853 wrote about this case. As these matters are now managed, a convict who has facility in writing and command of pen, ink and paper has his own fate in his hands, if he make an industrious use of his time and ply the press actively with letters under different signatures. So they're suggesting that Kerwin is doing this, that he's writing loads of letters in different handwriting and signing them with different names and sending them all over the place.
That would be really interesting if that was true, but I mean, feel like that's, I don't know, it could be.
There might be an element of it, but they say two or three letters a day, repeating the same story with confidence, impeaching the witnesses, and harping on the danger of taking the life of an innocent man will loose any halter. The public ends by taking fright, and the thing is done. So there is uproar aplenty.
It's so tricky because anyone could say anything and it immediately starts to plant doubt in your mind.
Jesus Christ. If we ever have Yesterday's Chip Paper t-shirts, it's just going to be, it's just going to have, it's strange because anyone could say anything.
that kind of sums it up, really.
Yeah. And it also, like we've said it before, everything before like 1990 was just made up. You couldn't check.
Yeah, arguably still a lot now.
Everything's just made up.
Yeah.
So the Southern Reporter and Court Commercial Courier, this is how opposed people were to this sentence. The Southern Reporter and Court Commercial Courier, 4th of January 1853, so 14 days before he's supposed to be executed.
Okay.
In consequence of considerable dissatisfaction being very widely felt with the respect to the conviction of Mr. Kirwan for the murder of his wife, a committee has been formed in Dublin in order to collect evidence which may throw further light upon the circumstances under which the unfortunate lady met her death. So there's like a club now. There's like a law club. And all of this, like there's entirely circumstantial evidence. There's letters, there's a law team, fucking alpha or whatever. It worked, and he wasn't found innocent, he wasn't cleared, but it was his death sentence. I think they recognized, the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland recognized that it would be a real stupid thing to do, to kill this guy with no real evidence and with so much public outrage.
Yeah,
so his sentence was commuted to a life of penal servitude, which
is not death.
It's not death, but it's certainly not like a nice cup of tea in the park.
So who made up the committee? Was it just self-proclaimed investigators?
Guys. The article didn't say.
That's really interesting.
It was kind of, that was mentioned in passing in the article because the committee sent the newspaper a rundown of all the evidence that they had. And the newspaper was writing about that. And a lot of the information that I got came from those affidavits and things. So anyway, the Bucks Herald on the 30th of April 1853, which you may notice is past the date he was supposed to be executed, he was sent to the Swan River settlement in the Robert Small. Huh? And this is before the Civil War, so that's just pure coincidence.
That's
Robert,
so funny.
We did an episode on Robert Smalls a few episodes ago, who was a slave who stole a Confederate ship. So the fact that there was a ship named after him before he did that is great. I don't mean. He's to be forwarded to the Swan River settlement in the Robert Small transport vessel, which was reached Queenstown to take out convicts for that colony. And yeah, and when you asked earlier about him being wealthy or not, I found a notice of the sale of his belongings for the 24th of November 1853 in the court constitution that amounted to £4,500. They auctioned all his stuff off. So I think he was doing all right.
1850s, yeah.
Yeah.
It's got to be quite good. With eight kids, that's a feat.
Well, I mean, he's not paying maintenance. I don't know what I don't know what the life was like for the eight kids. But there's another strange thing that is kind of alluded to in a few articles that I couldn't really put a pin in and figure out what was going on. This character appears a Mrs. Bowyer, and the London Evening Standard reported that Mrs. Bowyer had disappeared. She was a former colleague of Kirwan. She disappeared and was receiving regular payments from Kirwan, which they claim was hush money, because Kirwan killed her husband.
Why?
It's out of nowhere. There's no corroborating evidence whatsoever. So it got to the point where the Evening Standard reported on the 17th of January 1853, in consequence, the premises occupied by Kirwan at the time of Bowyer's disappearance have been strictly searched in the hope of finding the dead man's remains. Floors and gardens have been dug up with as eager an industry as could be displayed in the most promising Australian diggings.
thanks.
But this is poor taste. Displayed in the most promising Australian diggings, but the only nuggets, in inverted commas, so they said nugget, they refer to this as a nugget, yet obtained is the coffin skeleton of a baby.
That is shameful.
That's a chunky nugget. To all, So, but to all appearances, to all appearances, buried before Cohen was born. So now there's just dead kids. He's living above.
I don't understand what's happening.
He's living above a dead kid now. This we own surprises us. Remembering Kerwin's profession of an anatomical draftsman, we must have expected to hear that his garden was as well saturated with human remains as the celebrated Sparfield Cemetery itself. We all know that an anatomical draftsman must draw, if not from the life, from the death, and know too that as Southie...
Come on. Sorry, carry on.
Well, they're saying that this guy's killing people
to draw
them and taking body parts and things. As Southie tells, persons of his and kindred professions have little reverence for the remains of mortality, and then there's a poem... All kinds of carcasses I have cut up, the sextants have been my slaves. I have bottled babies unborn and dried, hearts and livers from rifled graves. So, what I would say to the journalist of the London Evening Standard, which maintains a similarly high standard of journalism to this day and age, there is a human baby's skeleton in a coffin underneath that room. Deal with that before you deal with poems. I
don't know what to say. We've heard a lot of things on this podcast, but it really felt like that one crossed a line.
I just feel like it probably was somebody who couldn't afford to have their child have a proper funeral.
Yeah.
Died at stillbirth.
Because this was in Australia by this point, right?
No, this is back in his house
in England.
No, this is in Ireland. When have you been in England in this story?
Sorry.
And then also The Standard, which again, bad newspaper. They claimed... that the reason that he got the death sentence in the first place was because he had converted to Protestantism and there were too many Catholics on the jury. The Dublin Evening Post reported on the 18th of January 1853, about 10 days ago, The Standard, commenting on a letter from the Irish Crown Solicitor exposing the falsehood of his imputations against the authorities concerned in Kerwin's prosecution, threw out additional and very scandalous imputations against the jury who tried the case. The jury, he says, was a mixed jury. Yes, mixed, but in very unequal proportions, viz. 11 Roman Catholics, and that's all in italics, and one liberal Protestant. Liberal is in italics. So they are suggesting that the reason that he was found guilty and sentenced to death was because he was a Protestant and they were Catholics. But then somebody who was on the jury writes back and says at least 5 of the jury were Protestants. So the Standard were just making things up. But they were making things up on both sides. So on one side, they're like, we think he's got bodies buried in his garden. And on the other side, they're saying he's innocent. It's just Catholics. Are they even referred to as papists?
It really does go back to the anyone can say anything thing.
Yeah, anyone can say anything. Do you know, for people who aren't in England or aren't in London, the London Evening Standard is handed out for free on the tube, and that is too much to pay for that newspaper.
Good crossword, though. Iron than that.
Is it? Yeah, it's all just lies, though.
You just think of the opposite of what the answer should be, and yeah, then you've got it.
Oh, it's a cloud with legs, and then the answer is like the sea. I don't know. I didn't work that out. But I don't like them. I don't like the Evening Standard.
Yeah. Can't say I've read it in a while.
And also, you know, when someone has a funny name.
Yeah.
Kerwin's lawyer was called Isaac Butt.
You mean Isaac Buck?
That's what I said.
Okay.
I kind of said it. I kind of didn't. So anyway, so he served his time. He went back to Ireland after quite a while. And then there's an article in the Western Morning News on the 23rd of February 1891, which annoyingly...
A long while after.
40 years after, yeah, near enough. Mm. I could have read this out instead of doing this podcast, but it sums it up quite nicely. But it was 40 years later, so I was just like, no, I want to capture the madness of all these things coming out, you know? So the Dublin Evening Telegraph of Saturday announced the release in prison of the notorious Irish criminal Patrick Buck Kerwin, who was convicted of the murder of his young wife, Maria Theresa Kerwin, on the island of Ireland's Eye in September 1852. The sentence of death was commuted to penal servitude for life. The murder was one of the most sensational in the annals of Irish crime. Kerwin was an artist by profession, and he and his wife resided at 11 Upper Merrion Street, Dublin. They'd been married for some years when she, according to the verdict of the jury, was murdered by him in the twilight of a December evening at Ireland's Eye. Kerwin led a double life, being a constant visitor to a woman in Sparfield, Sandymount, who was regarded by the people of that neighbourhood to be his wife. This intrigue had been going on for 6 years. Neither woman knew of the other's existence until a few months before the commission of the crime. Shortly before darkness shut out completely the outline of the island, cries were heard coming from it. A man named Campbell heard more than one loud cry. Others, living in Howth, heard screams, and a fisherman named Larkin, who was making for the harbour, heard them also. Just list the people who heard screams. I'm sick of it. The wails came from the direction of a place known as the Long Hole, which is hidden from Howth Harbour. Two boatmen proceeded to the island from Howth, and after a search of 2 hours, Mrs. Kirwan's body was found in the Long Hole. She was lying on the rocks with a bathing dress on, and blood was coming from several parts of the body. The defence was that the lady, while bathing, was seized with an epileptic fit, and that her screams and the blood were the result of the fit. Kirwan was defended by the late Mr. Isaac Butt, MP. And that's it. So I think, really hard to know based on the newspapers if he did it or not. But yeah, I just think if you just write that as kind of a narrative of everything that happens, it's just like, he's innocent.
Yeah, there were some really unnecessary reports in there. The things people started speculating. Going and digging up his garden, I mean...
Not even his garden, the garden he used to live at.
I wonder who lives there when they did that.
Oh, I don't know. Someone has now got a fucking haunted house because of a child that they didn't know about. But also, there were other things, like... And there was a Mrs. Byrne. And I can't work out if Mrs. Bowie or Mrs. Byrne were actually the same person because the stories are really similar. Mrs. Byrne claimed that... Kirwan killed her husband.
I'd completely forgotten about that part.
No, but there's another
just came
person
out of nowhere.
I think there's another person who accused him. I can't work out if they're the same person. So it's like, I don't know if an anatomical draftsman was just not trusted because they drew the insides of bodies.
Yeah.
Maybe people thought they were grave robbers and things like that. So yeah, just such a bonkers story.
Cool. Well, that was insane.
Yeah, it's an up and down story.
As a contrast, what I found this week, as well as these big stories that have all the twists and turns, sometimes it's nice to end a show with something that's just so ridiculous that there's even a record of this having been written.
An amuse-bouche.
That we can still find today.
a palate cleanser.
And this week's letter... Well, this show's letter.
This show's letter. Yeah.
Comes from not the Dundee Evening Courier.
Oh, what?
But the Aberdeen People's Journal.
Oh,
so,
just a little bit far away there. Okay.
On the 8th of July, 1939. So an interesting time.
July
1939. July 1939. It came with the headline, "Next, Please." And it said, "Dear Editor, seeing a nice-looking ham in a grocer's window, I entered the shop and asked for a pound. When I informed the assistant that I wanted it cut from the ham in the window, I was met with blank refusal and offered a pound from the counter instead. Needless to say, I refused this and came away without making a purchase, leaving in that shop a very indignant salesman. Signed, E.S. Dundee."
Does he even mention the... Like, he's from Dundee. Why is he writing to the Aberdeen?
He's from Dundee, and he's writing into the Aberdeen People's Journal.
The Dundee...
You know what?
The Dundee Courier was full.
Had standards.
No, they were just full. So, I have a theory.
Okay.
Do you want to hear my theory?
He felt really stupid a few months later.
Yeah, this wasn't a big issue a few months later. But do you want to hear my theory?
Go for it.
Window ham. Fake ham.
Just as you said window ham, I knew exactly where you were going with that.
Window ham, fake
maybe
ham.
Maybe he was slightly short-sighted. Got to give ES the benefit of the doubt.
I don't have to give ES jack. He wrote to the newspaper. He didn't even name the butcher. Do you know what this is? This is a Yelp review.
Yeah, this is true.
But he doesn't name
the
establishment.
2.5 stars for the display.
Yeah, 2.5 stars. They have fake ham in the window and real ham inside. It should be the other way around or something. No.
And then for the poem... This episode, we go to the Sheffield Weekly Telegraph on the 5th of November 1910 with the poem, which is actually written in prose, but it all rhymes, so it counts.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I don't know. They haven't done like the line breaks that usual poetry has. It's just a block of text.
Oh, okay.
So how this sounds will be interesting. But it came under the title, "A Shock for the Joke Editor."
Oh,
and it
God.
Says... "The storyette editor sat in his den, and his visage was puckered and blue. He was wading through piles of ancient jests that were stale when the world was new. Jokes of the plumber that Adam made when he was a gay young spark. Nautical wheezes by Mariner Noah when he sailed with his zoo in the Ark. There were jokes of goats, of mothers-in-law, of anglers and mythical fish. There were midsummer jestlets and Christmas puns, a widely assorted dish. But the editor knew them all by heart, and his heart grew black with guile as he read the jokes which the pharaohs told to the crocodiles down by the Nile. But all of a sudden, he gave a cry, and his breath came thick and fast, and he scanned a postcard eagerly, then shouted, at last, a brand new joke, can it be, ye gods? Yes, tis, I vow. Then his brain gave way with a horrid crack, and he's in the asylum now.
I don't know why. I mean, fine, whatever. But what it does immediately remind me of is that I was recently at a rodeo.
Right, as you do. Being in the States as you are.
When you live in these here continental United States of America. it was the first time I saw a Mennonite. But they have these things, rodeo clowns. And rodeo clowns are like the bravest men in the world. Bravest men and women. When the bulls go loose, when they throw the rider, the rodeo clowns get in their way and stop them attacking the rider. Like they put themselves in.
Yeah.
But the head clown is like more of a clown. And he tells jokes and things. He's got a microphone on. And he told a mother-in-law joke. In fact, he told three jokes and they were all about women. But he told a mother-in-law joke. And the punchline was that his mother-in-law would in the instance that he's talking about, die. And the whole crowd's hooting and hollering. So I find it interesting that in 1910, people were saying mother-in-law jokes were as old as creation.
Yeah, see, that's what I found so interesting about this poem is you recognised all of the jokes and it was 1910. Yeah. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, we're still telling the same ones, eh?
Yeah, but also, I mean, that rodeo clown should be careful because that could be used against him in court. Anyone can say anything these days.
Anyone can say anything, that's the problem. He actually told four jokes and one of them... The punchline had the word poo in it.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know what? If you're trying to tell jokes while you're also trying to avoid bulls, it sounds like he did quite well.
I keep him short.
Yeah.
I'd rely on...
Shortest words in the world. Only three-letter words.
I'd rely on audience interaction quite a lot. There'd be a lot of knock-knock jokes that I could scream from inside a barrel.
Knock-knock! Help me! I mean, who's there?
Bull. Bull who? He was in the Jungle Book. yeah. All right. Well, that might be one of my favourites that we've had.
That was actually quite good.
Yeah. I got to get a rodeo anecdote in there, so how often do you get that? that's all I have.
That's all I've got.
Right. Well, thank you for tuning in to this roller coaster of a podcast. if you get a minute... Please do pop over to iTunes and rate and review us in whatever territory you're in. Don't know why I said that. It's a bit fourth wall, but it really helps with algorithms that we don't understand.
It really does help. And if you want to find us on Facebook or Twitter, we're at Paper Podcast on both.
And we're also doing a thing this month, which is August 2017, called, we're part of it, this thing is called Two Pods a Day. The hashtag is #2PodsADay, the number two. And they're showcasing independent podcasts like ours. So yeah, check that out on Twitter. They're doing two a day for the month of August.
All of the archives and other sources that we use for the making of this podcast can be found in the episode description.
And playing us out is Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rag.
Thanks to the Free Music Archive.
Yeah, Free Music Archive. International.
The International Rag.